This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
It's not just about watching the game. It's about betting on it. I'm Mike Valeni, and on Cash the Ticket, Jim Costa and I break down every college football and NFL matchup like it's the last game we're ever going to watch. From the best bets to the sneaky underdogs, and of course, as my co-host likes to say, the value. And the one thing we're not going to do is pretend we're professionals. We have fun with it. It's an entertainment product, and it makes watching games a hell of a lot of fun. So Cash the Ticket, follow it in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everyone. On this episode, we talk with one of the two sports stars of the 1980s and 90s, former Minnesota Vikings running back and New York Mets outfielder, DJ Dozier. In the same era that Bo Jackson knew everything, Deion Sanders was prime time in two sports, Dozier was a two-sport athlete with a little less notoriety, but well accomplished in his own right. DJ Dozier was a running back at Penn State in the mid-1980s. He rushed for over 3,000 career yards, was an All-American his senior year when he helped lead Penn State to a national championship, and finished eighth in the Heisman Trophy vote. Dozier was drafted in the first round of the 1987 NFL Draft by the Minnesota Vikings. He played parts of four seasons with the Vikings and one with the Detroit Lions. Dozier's two-sport career is a bit strange. He was good enough as a high school baseball player to be drafted in the 18th round of the 1983 draft by the Detroit Tigers, probably higher if he wasn't holding a football scholarship to Penn State. Dozier did not play any baseball in college and didn't pick up a bat again until 7 years later when he joined the New York Mets organization in the spring of 1990. For the next 2 years, Dozier bounced between football and baseball and showed some promise as a baseball player. In his first pro season in 1990, Dozier posted an .882 OPS in nearly 500 plate appearances. He earned a brief call-up to the Mets in 1992, though he batted just .191 in 47 at-bats. DJ's baseball godfather was Joe McElvain, the former Mets executive and general manager who first signed Dozier for the Mets in 1990 and then traded for him 2 years later when McElvain was GM of the San Diego Padres. And while Dozier found himself in spring training hitting alongside Tony Gwynn, Fred McGriff, and Gary Sheffield, his playing career never materialized after that. After AAA stints with the Padres and Cardinals, Dozier's sports career ended altogether in 1993. Dozier's two-sport ability is part of the story we explore here. After that, we discuss a book he authored in 2018 called Decide to Dominate. It's in the inspirational life coaching genre and hits on some principles I've explored as well, how and when people decide to take their talents and become not just good, but great. I first met DJ at a book signing on the Penn State campus in 2018. I reconnected with him last month after reading some passages in his book that hit home to me. On life as a two-sport star and some principles of sports that apply to anyone in real life, here is my conversation with DJ Dozier. DJ, the first thing I want to ask you is, you had been away from baseball for a good number of years, concentrating on football. 4 years in college, a few years already in the NFL. You were drafted out of high school in 1983. You decided to give baseball a shot again in 1990. What made you go back to the sport then?
Yeah, great question. So a little bit of background. You know, at Penn State, I was actually supposed to play both sports. And part of the deal with Paterno, or at least Paterno came up with the deal, was that my first year that I would spend the entire year playing football. And then after my second season of football, then I could participate in baseball. And so, unfortunately, after my second season at Penn State, I had to get orthopedic surgery. And it wasn't major, major enough, I would say, though, to keep me from playing baseball. At least from my perspective, I wanted to just focus on rehab and being ready for my junior year football. And so I ended up not playing baseball after that season. And then I had a conversation with the baseball coach and some of the baseball players, about joining them in 85. You know, it dawned on me that I was just a step away from the NFL. And so I unfortunately declined to play baseball. That was my last shot to play. And so I ended up not playing at Penn State. And, you know, what's funny is when I got drafted by the Minnesota Vikings in 87, the World Series, the Twins were playing St. Louis Cardinals.
Yeah.
World Series. And so it's funny because during that time, I had reporters actually asking me about baseball. I read, some old articles. Said, hey, you know, have you ever thought about playing baseball? And I said, well, you know, not really. I said, but, you know, I think I could do it if, I have to get some rust off. And so what happened was I ended up going to the World Series. And end up getting tickets. So after the first game, I mean, what an amazing experience. Because, you know, where I'm from here in Virginia, the closest we had to a major league team was a triple A team here called the Norfolk Tidewater Tides. And they were affiliated with the Mets. And I knew the folks at Dave Rosenfield, president of the minor league team. But anyway, so I go to the World Series. I go to game one, have an incredible experience. And I believe it was at game two that I'm watching the game and I just have this thought. And the thought was, I can do this. Or I was actually looking down at the batter and I said, I can do that. And that's the thought I had. But that experience left me with this taste of playing, you know, the atmosphere. I mean, it was just exciting. What's funny is that thought was probably the seed that eventually grew because it was years later that I literally, and I mean this every sense of the word, I literally could not stop thinking about it. After the football season, I had to do something. I mean, it was that overwhelming. I mean, it was like, if I didn't do this, that I was going to go nuts. And, you know, I prayed about it. I thought, you know, many days, weeks about it. And eventually, you know, I heard someone say, well, you know, just do it. You know, just do it. And so I made a phone call to my agent. And told him, and he, you know, I tell the story. I said, you know, when I called him, I said, look, I said, hey, Brett, I want to play professional baseball. And that's what I heard, silence. Like 15, 20 seconds. And then he says, well, what do you want to do that for? And I said, I have to. I need to do it. And he agreed. I said, okay. He goes, well, all right. He goes, look, I know some folks over at the Phillies because he actually worked out of Coshocton, PA, where his office is still. And he says, you know, I know some other folks in the league. He said, and I said, well, you know, also, of course, Detroit drafted me. I said, but after 2 years, they lost my rights. And I think the A's picked it up. So let's get a hold of those two teams. And then I said, also give Dave Rosenfield down in Tidewater. And I said, because Dave always said, hey, DJ, don't forget about baseball. Don't forget about baseball. I don't care how many years. Don't forget. And so lo and behold, he called Dave and Dave said, listen, I'm going to get back to you. So Dave, we found out later, then called Joe McElvain. And I don't know if you know that name.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he called Joe Mack, and Joe Mack said he wants to play baseball. He wants to at least try. And he says, listen, I'm the guy that scouted him in Tidewater. I still have his scouting report.
Wow.
And he says, absolutely, we'll give him a shot down here. So whatever he wants to show up. And so that opened the door for me to go down to St. Lucie, Florida, and try out with the Mets.
This is an era, DJ, where you're talking about 1987. Bo Jackson has already made the jump. He is now playing both sports. We're a couple of years away from Deion Sanders doing both. Other guys had to make a choice. John Elway made a choice and chose football. But it's not the norm. You know, what kind of, you said your agent was on board and the Mets were gung-ho about it. They obviously knew you were a football player. What kind of resistance did you meet to trying to become a guy who didn't just make the choice, I'm going to play this rather than this. This is about trying to do both at the same time.
Yeah, no, great question. So what's interesting is when we started contacting the teams, and one of the teams I left out was the Minnesota Twins. And so sure enough, I thought, you know, they would at least have something positive to say. And it was just the opposite.
Wow.
I think when my agent spoke to their GM or whoever he spoke to, they pretty much saw it as a publicity that I was just doing it. You know, and obviously they didn't understand the background, my background of baseball. And, you know, so that did happen. Even some of the players from the Minnesota Vikings had some negative comments. And I understand, you know, why they were saying it. You know, they felt like I should be my off season preparing for, you know, the football season,
right,
rather than playing baseball. But, you know, of course, you know, in my mind, I had to do this. This became a dream. It wasn't a dream before. You know, I thought it was gone. And, you know, there I was sitting in the stadium watching a World Series, and then, you know, the lights went on. But there wasn't a lot of resistance. You know, my dad did say to me, he said, well, you know, in doing this and going after this, just make sure you don't forget about the kids. And what he meant by that is, you know, giving back and spending time, you know, giving back in areas rather than, you know, moving in directions that may or may not be prosperous. But not a whole lot of resistance. And quite frankly, I mean, it wouldn't have mattered. I was always taught that no matter what anybody says or thinks, you know, you take what you believe and have and you make something of it. What's funny is when I made up my mind that I was going to do it, I stopped wondering if I could and then started planning how it was going to happen. And of course, now that's in the mind. When I officially got there, it was a whole nother story.
Yeah.
it was quite an experience because when I first got to St. Lucie, my first batting practice literally was going against Mike Gooden. And now he wasn't throwing 100%.
Yeah.
But he was throwing hard.
Yeah.
But he was on rehab.
Okay.
And so they thought that would be a perfect situation, you know, to have me go against his strong arm. That was my first BP when I got to St. Louis.
Wow. Do you remember how it went?
Yeah, it went pretty well. Matter of fact, it's funny because, well, you know, when I was back in Minnesota training, and that's a whole nother story, because I was trying to do it in incognito.
Yeah.
And so I walk into this facility, this gentleman, his name's Steve Sagdahl, and he had a facility. He was the lead trainer, and he was also the former baseball coach for the University of Minnesota. So he was running this facility. And so I walk in and you know, announce my name is William, and that I just wanted to get some exercise and you know, hit a few balls, throw some. And after like the third day, a fourth day of me coming in, he said, "Hey, let me ask you a question. Like, what are you trying to achieve?" And I said, "You know, I need to tell this guy something." I said, "Well, you know, actually, I want to try out." And he says, "Oh, okay, cool." He says, "So when's the last time you played?" And I said, "Well, almost 7 years ago." He said, "Oh." He says, "Well," he goes, "listen, my suggestion to you is before you do that, why don't you play like an independent league and sort of move into that level?" And I said, "I can't do that." I said, "I got a tryout with the Mets in 3 weeks." He goes, "Oh." He says, "Well, look, I tell you what, I can't teach you everything in 3 weeks, especially." He said, "But I can at least get you to a point where you look like you know." Mm-hmm. And so that was his goal, that, you know, even if I didn't know what I was doing, that I would look like I knew what I was doing. So there I was in the batting cage against Doc. And one of the instructors, as I'm approaching the ball, he goes, "Man, look at him." He says, "I mean, he knows what he's doing." And in my mind, I'm thinking, if he only knew.
That's great.
I don't know what I'm doing.
I'm curious. I want to get into the training aspects of it in a minute, but I'm just looking at your minor league numbers, your first season in the minors. Now, this is, you're 24 years old playing. You crossed two levels, A and double A, in 1990 with the Mets.
Yep.
And as you mentioned, it's been 7 years since you played baseball of any kind, really, other than trying to train for it in that short period of time. But you had almost 500 trips to the plate, and in modern, looking at it with modern metrics, you had an incredible first season, especially for having spent so much time away. You hit over 300. Your on base was almost 400. You drew 61 walks. So you had an idea at the plate of balls versus strikes. You struck out 100 times, which back then I'm sure sounded like a lot. But today, versus 60 walks, it really doesn't. And you slugged almost 500. You had 10 triples, 15 homers, 16 doubles. I mean, you were making an impact on the ball. You had an idea of the strike zone. And you had, you know, for coming from football, you had some pretty incredible durability. You played 122 minor league games. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty remarkable season for anybody playing minor league baseball, let alone somebody who hadn't played in 7 years.
Yeah, well, the thing about baseball in this area, meaning Tidewater, baseball was big. My high school back in the 80s, in late 70s and 80s, I mean, they were one of the powerhouses in the state. So baseball in our area was, and so, you know, what happens with that is instructions. Instruction or coaching is at a high level as well. Okay. And so I was fortunate. And there's, I can pinpoint, I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, number one, my father, you know, and always inspired me, no matter what. And he's a huge sports fan. You know, he'll watch anything sports. So he spent a lot of time with me, baseball, football, basketball, it didn't matter. And so going back to high school, right before my junior year, there was a gentleman on our team. His name's Paul Chounds. And his father, you know, I guess saw some things in me and said, "Look, come to my house on Saturday. I want to teach you how to hit the ball to the opposite field." And so no one had ever taught me anything. I never even heard that. And so went to his house and literally spent, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours in their batting cage. And this man taught me how to hit the ball, how to take that outside pitch to right field. Now, you know, if you don't learn that and you go through your career, whether you make it to college, pros, whatever, that's a huge hindrance as a hitter. You know, Rod Carew, I mean, that guy could spray it all over the place, right? But he had to learn how, you know, to hit the ball to opposite field, you've got to hit it deeper into the zone. You know, if you're out front, more than likely it's going to be a grounder somewhere and you're normally out, right? So learning that part of the game at the plate was an absolute game changer for me because, I mean, I was already a good hitter, but that put me over the edge. Mm-hmm. My next season, you know, with maturity as well as ability at the plate, I hit 450. And then my senior year, I ended up hitting 500. And so I was a good hitter, but I had great instruction growing up. And you know, you look at the guys that come out of high school, that come out of college, that are ready. And most of those guys, and I learned this watching baseball, but most of those guys have had, you know, for example, if we play 18 games in Virginia, high school season, and then we end up playing another 25 or so games in the league, the local leagues in the summertime. Okay, so that's roughly, 40, 50 games. Well, in California, those guys play, who knows, 100, yeah. 150 games in that same year because of the weather. And so what I end up getting was repetitions. And that's what Mr. Challenge helped me. I mean, at the end of that day, in the batting cage, I knew how to hit the ball to the right field. And again, that was a game changer for me. And it showed in my batting average.
What kind of a physical toll does it take when you're spending several months of the year playing professional football in the NFL and then playing, high level AA, AAA baseball, and not just, this isn't you're spending a summer playing 30 games. You're playing full seasons practically in minor league baseball too. What kind of a physical toll does it take on you? How does your body feel going from one to the other? What kind of training did you have to do to make sure you didn't sacrifice one sport for the other sport?
The most telling issue in terms of going from baseball back to football, and I learned this lesson after the first year of playing, really after the first year of trying out. The most telling issue was the workout program, because during the baseball season, you can't work out for football. And that hurt me in that following year in 90, I think, at least in terms of physical preparation for football. In terms of going from football to baseball, not so much. Simple transition.
Okay.
You're not doing as much lifting. It's more flexibility. Although, today and even back then in the early 90s is when baseball started to believe in a little more weightlifting. Mm-hmm. Because for many years, like, you don't want to get near weights.
Right.
Make you too tight. You become bulky and this and that, less flexible. And so by 90, 91, I learned how to prepare myself for football coming out of baseball. And so I would do a little more lifting, not heavy lifting, but at least something just to maintain something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was I 100% prepared in terms of physical strength and endurance for football? No. But I was living my dream of playing both. And, but I did learn how to, make some modifications. But that was really the biggest challenge, is that level of preparation for the weight training.
When you got your cup of coffee in the big leagues in 1992, it wasn't a great sample. It wasn't a large sample. You got a little bit of time. You played 25 games. You came to bat 54 times. What I mentioned earlier didn't get a chance to really shine through in such a small sample and at the higher level. Your plate discipline, you're hitting for power. Those types of things didn't show up in 47 at bats. 4 walks, 19 strikeouts, 2 extra base, 9 hits, 2 extra base hits. So your major league numbers pale in comparison to what your minor league potential showed, and you only had that one small sample. You experienced what it was like taking, the speed of the game, going from college to NFL. What was the speed of the game like going from minor league baseball to major league baseball?
Oh my goodness. Let me tell you, what a difference. Hmm. What a gap. I learned a bunch, but there are a couple of things that I remember. Our hitting instructor with the Mets, the big league, he would always say, he said, listen, in the big leagues, you have to be able to hit the fastball. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, everybody hits the fastball. He says, because a real hammer or a curveball, you're not going to hit it. Now, I grew up through high school hitting everything. So that philosophy didn't make any sense to me. And I actually rebelled against it.
Hmm.
Until my first bat in the big leagues.
Yeah.
And I saw that hammer he was talking about. And I stepped out of it. It was against Cincinnati. We were in Three Rivers. I stepped out of the box. You know, of course, no one could tell, but I'm thinking in my mind, are you kidding me? Yeah. That's the hammer he was talking about? But when I saw that hammer, I then realized why Tommy, the hitting instructor, said, whatever you do, do not swing. Because if you swing, you miss royally. That's all you're going to see the rest of your career.
That's funny.
So thank goodness I didn't swing. I ended up getting a fastball. I hit it to the shortstop. Now, I ended up getting on base because I beat it out. But he pulled in an error because I guess he bobbled it.
Okay.
There's no doubt that the difference between the minors to the majors, there's no real comparison from college to the NFL. I mean, it's a big gap. But that gap in baseball is incredible. And quite frankly, you know, in the major leagues, you need at least somewhere between 300 and 500 at-bats at that level. Right. You know, because again, you're practicing at this level, you're not ready for that level. And no matter how much practice you have at this level, you'll never be prepared for that level. You have to get big league at-bats in order to become a big league hitter. And because it's night and day, it's almost like a different game. Definitely, I mean, you're talking about guys that can put 2, 3, 4 pitches wherever they want it. And versus, you know, in the minor leagues. And, you know, to test that theory, when I got back to the minor leagues, it was literally the first week or two, it was like taking candy from a baby. I mean, I'm thinking, that's your curveball? You know, versus what I saw, yeah. That's your slider? You know, that's your changeup. And so it really opened my eyes. Unfortunately, in my, you know, obviously we can see my career, I didn't get enough at bats. See, I got injured before I got called up to the bigs. And I hurt my knee toward the middle in the season. And technically, I shouldn't have played.
Okay.
But I wanted the big league experience.
Sure.
And so what happened was Jeff Torberg was our manager with the Mets at the time. And after that, like that, about the 20th game or so, he said, look, I can tell you. I mean, I was literally icing after every game. I was, you know, my knee, I had torn my posterior cruciate early in that season. And so I was still in recovery. He finally said, look, I'm going to sit you down. Because, you know, I was limping around the bases. So I ended up not getting enough at bats there. And I think what happened was, I think the injury was severe enough for the management to make me part of that package that traded me to the Padres,
mm-hmm.
and where Joe Mack was.
I want to ask you about the couple of things that I saw in your book, and I purchased this book when I met you on campus a couple of years ago. I hadn't really cracked it open, but the title called out to me from my bookshelf because very recently I've crystallized this idea in my head that mostly I see it with athletes, but I think it applies in a lot of areas of life too. And maybe I subconsciously took this from your title too, but it was, I have this idea that an athlete has talent. A lot of athletes have talent, but there comes a moment in their lives and their careers when they have to decide for themselves they want to be great. You know, they have to take that extra step because the talent is in there, but there's a certain extra gear that only the player can really decide to bring out. A lot of times when potential isn't reached, blame goes towards coaches or opportunities or different things. But I feel like in the end, there's something inside of the athlete that has to come out to make him great and take all the other stuff out of the equation. You know, forget about other people's thoughts or decisions. Your performance will dictate. Well, the title of your book is called Decide to Dominate. And I wonder if, before I ask you about a couple of quick passages, I wonder if what I'm describing sounds similar to what you kind of thought about when you decided to lay this out in book form.
Yeah, so without a doubt. And I was very, very, very fortunate growing up. You know, number one, having a father that understood hard work and worked hard all his life, you know, teenager and certainly as an adult. My mom the same way. So I grew up in a home where hard work was normal. A lot of homes like that, right? Mm-hmm. But also inspiration was normal. Anytime I asked my parents a question, they always gave me a positive answer. Mom, can I do this? Oh, absolutely. I mean, so there was always reinforcements. I never had any doubt from that perspective. There's also times in your development, whether it's when you were young or in age or older, something has to happen. Something has to turn on or it doesn't get turned on. And so early on, I didn't know how good I was. Until I was 12 years old, that particular year I had to play, because I was a pretty big kid. So at 12, I was 138 pounds. And so that took me away from most kids that were 12. And I had to participate in a team in a league where, you know, guys were anywhere from 14 to 16. Matter of fact, I remember one of my teammates used to drive the practice because he was 16. So there I was, a 12-year-old, and I end up becoming the starting running back. But let me tell you, I went through some pretty interesting and I would say tough times. I don't remember. I couldn't say why the coach did it, but, you know, maybe they were trying to make me tough. I don't know. But for a 12-year-old to play with, you know, at that point, in my mind, these guys were men.
Yeah.
Right. That was a call to task. And so my coach did the things that he thought were necessary to make me tough, even though I was a kid. And then I remember that one of the games, it was a night game, and I made a spin move on somebody and ended up taking it to the house. And again, I'm 12. And for me, that's when I realized that I have this talent. Hmm. You know, because if I can compete, I mean, you know, you to do that against a 12-year-old, another 12-year-old or 11-year-old, you know, yeah, I mean, you have some talent. But to be able to do that against people that are, you know, 2, 3, 4 years older than you, that's a whole nother thing. And so in my mind, it hit me like, man, you know, you have some talent. And, you know, I was never, thank goodness, never conceited. My parents wouldn't allow that, my dad especially. He, even when I got in high school, you know, started getting a lot of attention, you know, he said, look, no matter what, you got to remember, this is a team sport. And you don't go anywhere without the line and the quarterback on his job. And so forth and so on. So give credit where credit is due. And so he always reminded me to, you know, when it came to talking about different things as related to the game or games, that it was always about everybody else. You know, yeah, I did my job, but everyone else did their job. And that's why we ended up, you know, where we did. And I've always thought that way. So, as it relates to the book, that's the way I grew up. You know, I grew up where if you see something or you see something, then you seize it. I literally woke up one morning and I heard the words, sort of two-pronged. I mean, it's a message, but it was also, I mean, it was a message to the outside world, but it was also a message to me that you may have achieved certain things over here and over there and over there, but there's still so much more to do. And the only way you're going to do it is you've got to decide what you're going to do. And you've got to put yourself in a position to achieve greatness and really, at the end of the day, to achieve all that God wants.
I want to highlight a couple of things specifically that I think are really important and meaningful. I want to get your take on what this is all about. Success, and again, this applies not just to sports, but it applies to life and business and any other field. And you cite a lot of examples of that too, people that you've run across in your life and in business too. But one part I took about this is, you know, we hear a lot about process in athletics and athletes going through with, you know, endless practice to get to where they want to be. The idea is that success is a process. And you articulate that here when you say, success and failure are at times processes of doing small, tedious tasks the right or wrong way every day that helps you achieve what you desire or what you do not desire. Success is never an event. It is an unfolding process of small actions that may seem insignificant, but they lead up to a person of character or not, good health or not, or a person who is prepared to succeed in business and life or not. It all seems to be, you seem to be telling everybody that it's all a very conscious effort.
It's all about effort. And well, you know, here's what's funny. So, we've all heard the term practice makes perfect, mm-hmm. Especially if you've been involved in any level of sports. Practice makes perfect. Well, Paterno sort of added to that. And he would say, it's perfect practice that makes perfect. Mm. And so the process of practicing is certainly valuable. But the process of practicing to be the process, you're going to have moments when you're moving in the right direction. You're going to have moments when you fail. But that overall process of practicing, you're learning from each experience. And so being able to practice with perfection in mind, it causes you to start to examine the details of that process. So another Paterno example. So in practice, we would have, you know, obviously you practice on certain things. Well, his practices were literally, I mean this literally, scheduled by the minute. Hmm. And if we were going to spend 6 minutes on fundamentals, it would be from literally, it would be from 10:35 to 10:41. And I remember looking at the schedule one day, I'm thinking, why wouldn't we just go to 10:45?
Right.
You know, or 10:50.
Yeah.
But what I believe what he was signaling is in any process, you have to look at the details. The only way that you can create a perfect process is by examining the details and working in each one of those details. For example, each minute mattered. Mm-hmm. And so now, were there times when you had to stretch that 6 minutes to six and a half? Yes. Seven? Absolutely. But it was noted. We need, in order to be ready for Saturday, we need 6 minutes of fundamentals all four of these days. And, you know, maybe on Thursday, instead of six, it's going to be seven. but, you know, roughly it's going to be 24 to 26 minutes. And when you start to examine, I mean, that was phenomenal to me. And I examined it a little bit while I was in college, but when I reflect back to it, I really, you know, I've looked at that and I think that's it. I mean, being able to not just go through a process and think about perfection. And, you know, I do want to add a little bit more to that. I mean, you have to give yourself the opportunity to fail, right? I mean, being perfect is not putting pressure on yourself. It's a destination. It's a bullet point. I mean, it's a bullseye. And just because you missed the bullseye, you know, doesn't give you the right or shouldn't give you the right to become discouraged. You should learn why you missed the bullseye. And allow that to add to the details of what happens next. And you continue to compile. I mean, it's no different than Thomas Edison. And I talk about that in the book, you know, how he continued to try to find ways to invent certain things. And, you know, when someone asked him, how does it feel to fail over our times? He responded in a different manner, right? Yeah. We know how he responded. He said, I haven't failed. I've successfully found over 1,200 ways how it doesn't happen. Right? So, you know, but being able to focus on the process and the details of that process is game changing.
The other one that kind of jumped out to me is it relates to advice that I often give when people ask me about, you know, careers in media and getting to certain places. Listen, we all have high aspirations, but one of the things I tell people is you're not going to jump to it right away. Say, do the job you're given, do it well, and people will notice. Because, you know, we all want to get to the top, but
Right. Don't
appear to be above the job that you have now, because other people hold those positions. It's just going to take the natural process of time to get to where you want to be. And you call it taking responsibility for the mail. You write, if you're in the mailroom, do not take responsibility for the entire company. Take responsibility for the mail. Do it with excellence and connect to how you are doing your job affects the company. Dominate in the mail and accept dominion over your area. Dominion is ownership as it relates to the position and is responsible for that portion. A person who shows themselves faithful in even the smallest things can be trusted with larger things. I think it's a wonderful piece of advice.
Yeah, and that's biblical wisdom, right? Before you can be given, you know, 10 things, you start with one, maybe even a half, and become successful at that. And again, it goes that part of being successful is being able to focus. We know that.
Yeah.
And how can you focus if you're trying to do your job and then trying to do someone else's job or, you know, other people's jobs? And so being able to focus on the tedious job and then mastering that allows you to expand, you know, as the Bible says, to expand your borders, right? I mean, this is like starting a franchise, right? You don't start off with 5 locations.
Yeah.
You start off with 1 and you build a system so that you can build on that system beyond that. I mean, let's face it. I know in my little bit of investigation, the best CEOs are the ones that started in the mailroom. You know, are the ones that started at the ground floor of the company because they understand every aspect of the business, and it allows them to feel the weaknesses and the you know, have a heart for the people that are in other positions, especially those, you know, that are down below. Because, you know, let's face it, as one of the things that happens at some companies is the executives have no connection to what's going on in the heart of their business. And so they're making decisions that are based on up here and not reflected from the customer or reflected from their own, what I call the internal customer, their employees, right? If you're not hearing them, I mean, all the way down to the bottom, then your output, your strategies, your execution potentially be detriment and certainly hinder.
DJ, first of all, thank you for all this time. There's so much more to talk to you about at some point in time. Maybe we get to do this again. But the last thing I want to ask you about is I think it's pretty clear statistically you had more success in football than you did in baseball. But I'm wondering which sport taught you more.
Oh, boy. Definitely baseball, because it's more individual. You know, it's a team sport, but, you know, you're at bats. Individual at bats. And, you know, again, team, and you're part of the team. But, you know, the things that you can learn so often. In football, you know, the way I look at it, at least from my position, is very much instinctual. It's all about instincts. It's not necessarily, now you learn how to play at that level, yes, but it's instinctively react. And in baseball, it's such a, you have to develop skill and, you know, high level skill, for that matter. And again, it's such a, you know, of course I'm focusing in as a hitter, everyday player, not a pitcher, but it's the same thing for a pitcher. I mean, every pitch, you know, maybe not so much every pitch, but certainly every game, these guys have to learn. From the, not to say that you don't learn from every game in football, but it just there's a level of detail, in my opinion, that that's more expressed in baseball, and certainly more monitored in baseball, in football, at least, you know, from an everyday player perspective, and even, you know, errors, right? I mean, you know. Now, of course, in football, as a running back, you have fumbles. That doesn't happen very often. It shouldn't. but in baseball,
you don't get to keep doing it if it happens a lot.
Exactly. No. Exactly. Yeah. You don't want to do it either. You know, because you get all the boos. I mean, who wants to hear 80,000 people booing you if you fumble three times in a game, right? yeah. I mean, in baseball, it's just. I don't know. I've always saw baseball as a greater challenge. And certainly going from the minor leagues to the big leagues, from an athletic standpoint, greatest challenge I've ever experienced. I mean, just bar none. Just incredible.
My thanks to DJ Dozier. His book, Decide to Dominate, is available in paperback on Amazon. If you're new here, or if you missed some of our previous episodes, please check out the archive at radio.com or at Apple Podcasts. You can hear recent conversations like the one I had with former Mets pitcher Bill Pulsifer, one of the poster children for pitch counts and innings limits in the modern game. Also, a chat with Karate Kid screenwriter Robert Kamen for his thoughts on the Netflix series Cobra Kai. Go back and listen, also subscribe and review and all that jazz. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thanks for listening.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
O'Reilly. Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
It's not just about watching the game. It's about betting on it. I'm Mike Valenti, and on Cash the Ticket, Jim Costa and I break down every college football and NFL matchup like it's the last game we're ever going to watch, from the best bets to the sneaky underdogs. And of course, as my co-host likes to say, the value. And the one thing we're not going to do is pretend we're professionals. We have fun with it. It's an entertainment product, and it makes watching games a hell of a lot of fun. So Cash the Ticket, follow it in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.